brilliant portal, searing my eyes. A feeling of flying, soaring into the sky and then turning to look down at the temporary fairgrounds, trash strewn and windswept, with a few bonfires still burning. I winced and shut down the flow because my head hurt. And because I hadn't done those things. I had been passed out on a cracked subfloor under a couple thousand pounds of troll, with a ton of bouncy toys and a freaked-out boyfriend. I remembered Luis César yelling my name, hands lifting me, gentle as a baby, some confused shouting, and rocketing through an intersection in a troll-laden truck while a witch with cigarettes in her hair laughed and laughed. Luis César's fingers gently combed over my abused scalp.
The doctor said there should be no lasting damage, that Domfiers have the hottest heads she's ever seen.
I'm fine, I told him. Physically, anyway.
You won't be if you don't rest,
Luis César said.
You all but passed out on me a moment ago.
What? He nodded.
That's why you don't remember the last few minutes. You're so tired you drifted off.
I did not. His lips twitched, the worry suddenly eclipsed by what looked like genuine humor.
You look so indignant.
I'm not, I told him, and then thought about it. Okay, maybe I am, but I don't nap. Luis César's lips twitched some more. Stop doing that.
Then explain to me what is so wrong with a nap. I recall quite liking them once.
They're stupid, ridiculous, weak, dangerous. To zone out in a fight.
But you weren't in a fight. You were home, behind excellent wards, and I was here. It is hard to be safer than that.
I ignored the smug comment because he wasn't wrong. About that, anyway. I don't nap, I repeated.
Not normally, perhaps. But it is as the doctor said. You need time to heal. Time you haven't been taking.
He turned me around again and started lathering up my hair. I'm not hurt, I said, and tried to put some heat behind it, because the magic fingers were doing a good job of making me forget how serious this was. And that wasn't a nap. Don't you get it?
No, he said simply. Tell me.
Yeah, like it was that easy. To compress a lifetime of fear and struggle and pain into a few sentences when I never talked about it, not with anyone. Because who would care? And because I didn't know how. Only I guess I did, because it came out in a rush. I used to try all kinds of things to keep Darina under control. They didn't always work, but I got pretty good at it. Enough that I could tell when things were about to go bad and smoke some weed or walk away from a conflict, or punch a tree until I calmed down. But now?
Now?
Those damned fingers should be registered somewhere, I thought, unconsciously leaning back into the feel of them. Now everything's changed. Darina couldn't come out when I was conscious. The barrier prevented her. That was the whole point of it. I felt him nod. But now it's gone, and without it, there's nothing to keep her from showing up any time she feels like it. And what if she feels like it all the time? What if... I stopped for a moment, because I didn't do this shit. This touchy-feely, let's all share our deepest fears shit. It made me feel uncomfortable and vulnerable and a bunch of other things I hated. Made me want to run away or lash out at something, which usually worked pretty well to change the subject. But I couldn't do that this time. Luis César deserved the truth. What's stopping her from just taking over my life? I rasped. All of it, all the time, and shutting me out, for good this time. Like I had tried to do to her. I had always treated this as my life, all mine. Because, of course I had. I hadn't even known she existed until very recently. I'd spent years thinking that I just had fits sometimes, that it was the Damphir crazy coming out, and concentrated on finding ways to tamp it down, while hoping that someday someone would find a cure for my disease. Only to find out that I didn't have a disease. I had a twin. The word floated through my mind suddenly, frighteningly, because I hadn't put it there. Wouldn't have, since I'd never thought of us that way. We weren't twins, we weren't sisters. I didn't have a sister. I had a fucked-up mind, thanks to Mircea. And yes, maybe it had been necessary to save my life, but I didn't know that, did I? I had been there, but I couldn't remember any of it. Like I couldn't remember the last 15 minutes. Had I been asleep? Just nodding off in the warmth and security of my boyfriend's arms because I was that beat? Maybe. It had been a hell of a month, with things coming hard and fast, one after another, before I had time to blink sometimes, much less to heal. And although the family had some gifts in that area, with the war raging, most of them had been in need of help themselves. And anyway, they could only do so much. Sometimes, nature just had to take its course. So, yeah, maybe I'd drifted off when I never did. But I didn't know for sure. And neither did Luis César, no matter what he thought. He'd only met Dorina a couple of times, and both had been under duress. Would he feel that difference he talked about if she was just there? If she was just watching? I shuddered, and didn't manage to stop before he noticed. Luis César's hands stilled.
You truly think that is possible?
I don't know. I don't know anything anymore. I twisted around and my damned ribs rewarded me by shooting savage pain up my newly loosened spine. God damn it! Luis César's hands dropped unerringly to the source, sending warmth and relief coursing through me, despite the fact that I didn't want it. I didn't want to feel better. I didn't even know. Like I didn't even know what he was still doing up here. Why are you here? I asked wearily, looking up at him.
Why wouldn't I be?
Because when you hooked your wagon to the crazy, it wasn't this crazy. He just looked at me. I'm a disaster, I told him plainly. I always have been, and things aren't getting better. You ought to bail while you can. It hurt, even more than the ribs, but it was the truth. I'd always known it, but I'd hoped to hold on a little longer, to hold him. But things were starting to fall apart. I could feel it, and Irina.
Isn't here,
he told me mentally, because he could do that sometimes. All vampires could. Even babies could talk to family, and masters could communicate silently with almost anyone they chose. Except for me, who wasn't a vampire and who'd had exactly zero mental gifts for 5 centuries, until that wall started to fall. And all of a sudden, I was hearing voices. But not hers. She had the mental gifts, not me. I had no idea how to contact her, but she could talk to me any time she wanted. But she hadn't. Why talk to someone who won't even be around much longer? Why get to know someone you plan to kill?
Listen to me.
Luis César's hands came up to frame my face, his eyes fiercer than I'd ever seen them.
I am here. I'm not going anywhere. And no matter what happens, we will find a way to deal with this.
Looking into his eyes, I almost believed it. But I had learned the hard way not to want what I couldn't have, not to reach for things out of my grasp, not to hope for anything or anyone. Because who the hell would want to waste their lives on a crazy Damphir? And for years, I had been happy that way. Okay, maybe happy wasn't the word, but content, at least. Once I'd thought that things were going pretty well if I had a full stomach, a place to sleep in safety, a job to do, and no frightening episodes for a while. That had been the good life. That had been all right. So when had all right stopped being enough? I had a feeling it coincided with meeting a certain blue-eyed vamp who had somehow retained a measure of innocence that was ridiculous, just ridiculous in our world. He'd come out of nowhere with all these ideas, stupid, antiquated things like chivalry and nobility and decency, the stuff humans usually scoffed at, and that vampires... Well, I doubted some of them even knew the words anymore. I doubted some of them ever had. And yet here was Louis César, a ridiculous contradiction of a creature, determined to ride or die when the latter was a lot more likely, not caring that his girlfriend had a split personality that could kill him and just might for shits and giggles some day. He was a naive fool, and I should have kicked him to the curb as soon as I met him. But instead, here I was hoping again. So who's the fool now, I wondered, and pulled him down. Chapter 7. And God, he was good, because Louis César was always good. Even in a tub partially filled with soapy water, because the drain mostly didn't. But you couldn't beat the size of the thing, which was 6 feet long and comfortably roomy, because the Victorians knew how to make 'em. Yes, they did. Made you wonder what they got up to, all those upstanding citizens, when the curtains closed. That, I thought, arching up. If they were really lucky. Oh, yes, just like that. But good as it wasn't what I wanted tonight. Only I didn't know what that was. I just knew there was something... Something he seemed to understand, because he started kissing his way up my body a lot sooner than normal, stopping at all his favorite spots until he paused at my neck, right over the pulse point. I swallowed, my heartbeat speeding up, but he didn't bite, just rested his lips against the hot soapy skin under my hair, his own falling over my shoulder, his breath tickling my ear.
"What is it?"
he murmured, because I had tensed up, going rigid in his arms. I didn't answer because I didn't know, just gripped his shoulders, feeling the hard muscle underneath as he slid against me. And God, yes, that's what I needed, like the air I wasn't getting in panted breaths. My ribs protested, but I didn't care. My ribs could go to hell. And then he pulled away again. I stifled a scream, just... "What?" I breathed.
"We shouldn't be doing this," he said, frowning. "Not now."
"Oh, yes, we should." But he was getting that look again, that stubborn, I-know-best look that drove me half mad even when I wasn't already there. He was hard against my thigh, hot and huge and insistent, and so ready he was shaking with it. Typical of the man to be noble, even when need had turned to agony, too gentle or polite to take what he wanted. So I did it for him. With a cry of pure frustration, I flipped us, throwing him onto his back again and straddling him with efficient grace, wrapping one hand around the base of him and curling the other around the back of his neck. I sat down smoothly, and simultaneously pulled his mouth close enough to kiss, swallowing his protest. "Mine," I thought deliriously, and with a growl I ground my hips down, setting a ruthless pace, latching onto his neck with my teeth, and... Louis César froze. Suddenly everything slowed down, from the wave of soapy water splashing over the side of the tub, to the shower curtains billowing out to show the bathroom in flashes, to the heart beating hard under my lips. I told myself to let him go, to pull away... But I didn't appear to be listening. I managed to get my fangs out of his skin before they had done more than dent it. But then I stopped, like I'd hit a wall. I stared at that expanse of pale flesh, and a tingling spread over my skin, like a fever had gripped me. I could feel how it would taste as I bit down. It would be firm and slightly resistant, warm, with faint traces of soap and Louis César. My fangs would slide in, slick as glass, pushing past his body's defenses until the blood welled up, hot and thick and alive in my mouth. It was an insane thought to have. I didn't have the bloodlust of a vampire. I never had. Blood did nothing for me. I couldn't use it, didn't need it. But suddenly, I could taste it, wanted to, with a craving beyond any I'd ever had for anything. I wanted to bite deep into that vulnerable spot where shoulder met neck, not to harm, but to mark, to leave an unmistakable brand to everyone who saw him that this one was taken, this one was mine. I heard him swallow, felt the chest beneath me rise and fall faster, as if some of my intent had leaked over. But he didn't draw back, even when my lips ghosted over that exact spot again, when the faintest edge of my teeth grazed him. A shudder rippled through him and into me, and his hands clenched on my body, but to draw me closer, not to shove me away. His hand moved to my nape, sliding under the hot, wet strands of my hair, pulling me close. My tongue flicked out, laving the warm surface, his pulse beating hot and fast under my lips. His neck was smooth, free of any marks, an unbroken pale expanse that no one had ever dared to claim, because that wasn't how this worked. The more powerful vamp made the mark, and I didn't know too many more powerful than Louis César. The damned vamp had held another first-level master, the highest rank of all, in thrall for a century. So I was thinking power wasn't really a problem for him. So technically, it should have been him marking me, only he wasn't moving. But he wasn't moving away either, and I didn't know what that meant. I also didn't know that I could even do it. I wasn't a vampire. I'd never marked anyone in my life, not like that. But somehow I knew it would work, knew I could leave an indelible trace of our connection on his body, something no amount of time would erase. The urge was so overwhelming that for a moment I just clung to him, vibrating, my nails digging into his hip, his shoulder, deep enough that they threatened to leave marks of their own.
"Dory, don't," I growled, my voice low. "Don't talk."
I turned my head to the side and gulped in a breath, almost dizzy with the desire to finish this, and knowing I couldn't. Vampires bit often, but they marked, oh, so rarely. To do so was to make a final claim, an eternal commitment, a formal declaration of alliance that joined houses, bloodlines, and fortunes in a way that made a mockery of human marriage. And once done, it could never be undone. Not to have one at your side whom you had marked was one of the biggest signs of weakness possible. It could open him up to attack, to challenge, by those who didn't understand that the one who had marked him wasn't a vampire, wasn't someone who had the right, wasn't someone who had anything to offer. Not even herself, since half of me was owned by someone else. This was another one of those things I couldn't have. I knew that. But it's hard to think when your body is full and tingling, your nipple still throbs from his lips, and the rush of lust has made you light-headed. Yet I was trying to push back against the tide of instinct or desire or whatever the hell was wrong with me, and remember all the reasons this would be a very bad idea. It wasn't working. I growled again and felt him shift inside me, clamp down and heard him cry out, felt him begin to thrust in thick, stuttering strokes, so unlike his usual easy dominance, as my fangs started to dent that perfect skin again. And it was sweet, sweet. Oh, God, it was so fucking... Someone started pounding on the door. It was loud enough to cause my head to shoot up, my heart hammering, but it wasn't the bathroom door. That was just as Louis César had left it, still partly open to the next room. It was the one to the hall, where the rapping was loud and insistent enough to count as banging. One of the troll twins, I thought, because Sven and Imsi had a different definition of a soft knock than everybody else. Only I guess I was wrong, because a second later I heard a female voice.
Dory?
My roommate, Claire, with her famously bad timing.
I made some soup, she called. If you feel up to it.
I didn't answer. I'd never been so happy and so furious to hear her in my life. But apparently Luis Cesar did not have the same conflict of emotions.
I think, he told me, breathing hard, that there's a chance that I hate your roommate.
It's okay, I told him, grabbing a towel. I kind of think she hates you, too.
So it would appear.
He lay back against the tub, looking martyred, with a forearm thrown across his eyes while I disentangled us.
She's just trying to be protective.
I keep telling myself that,
he said grimly, as I started to get out of the tub. And tripped, which was not a good sign, since I'm supposed to have better reflexes than that, even on soggy rug and sud-strewn floors. But today it seemed like I was off balance in every way. Not that it mattered, since I was caught before I hit down and spun against the wall.
You're going back to bed,
Luis Cesar informed me flatly, somehow on his feet and in front of me, having moved with that liquid speed all vamps have, but which was somehow so much sexier with him.
Okay,
I perked up.
Alone, he said severely.
I sighed.
So you can heal.
It was savage. I blinked.
Properly. Finally. So that I may take you away, somewhere very far from this place, and make love to you until neither of us can see straight.
Sounded like a plan. So instead of getting vamp married, I got a trip back to La La Land, which sucked as a runner-up prize, but my body didn't seem to agree. Luis Cesar went to piss off Claire, and my stiff and sore muscles relaxed back into the familiar softness of my bed. Old, well-laundered sheets, a soft, threadbare duvet, and a comforter that I'd finally managed to bunch up in exactly the way I liked. It was heaven. I was out before my head hit the pillow. Mircea, Venice, 1458. Mircea knew before he reached home, before he even reached his street, that something was wrong. He broke into a run, one too fast for wet cobblestones or for the human his neighbors believed him to be, but they'd gone to bed by now, and he wouldn't have cared if they hadn't. He could feel her agony in his mind. He burst through the front door, tripping a little on the warped boards, into the tiny main room of their house, and immediately saw her. She wasn't in her room, in her bed, as she should have been. She was writhing on the floor, screaming loudly enough to wake the whole street, if the rain hadn't been bucketing down tonight. It was what had made him leave off his pursuit, for not even hunters could hunt in this, and when the storm clouds broke, the strange duo he'd been following had disappeared, along with their prey. He had turned for home, cursing the November weather, when it felt like it rained all the time. But now he was glad for it, because his old servant clearly didn't know what to do. Of course, neither did Mircea.
It started a few moments ago. She was fine at dinner,
Horatu told him, fluttering about. The kindly old face was splashed on one side with light from the adjacent kitchen. It wasn't much. The coals had been banked for the night, with just a few glimmers of red peeking through the ash. But for a vampire's eyes, it was enough. To see the fear in Horatiu's clouded gaze, to see the blood staining his worn nightshirt, to see it wringing Dorina's mouth and glinting redly on her teeth. The one she shouldn't have had, because she wasn't a vampire, but which protruded past her lips anyway when she had her fits. Because she wasn't human, either.
You're hurt,
Mircea said, focusing on the old man's shoulder where the stain was darkest.
She wanted to leave. I tried to stop her. She didn't like that. Here.
Mircea reached for him, but Horatu shook his head.
Her first. After our tussle, she collapsed. I was afraid she'd choke.
Mircea noticed a small piece of leather from an old belt he'd broken and hadn't yet had repaired on the floor. Bitten clean through.
Go wash yourself,
he told Horatu.
It's easier to heal if I can see the wound.
Horatu made a disgusted sound.
It's a little thing. She didn't mean it. I know that. She was in pain. Still is. I know that, too. Then help her. Or are you afraid, boy?
No one else ever spoke to Mircea like that. But Horatu wasn't just a servant. The old man had been his tutor once, and more since Mircea had rarely seen his parents while growing up. They were always busy with their own affairs, their own ambitions. Ambitions that had eventually gotten them killed. But Horatu had made a fine enough substitute, and that was before the curse and the butchering of Mircea's family that followed it. When everyone else had attacked or deserted him, when his own nobles had tried to kill him and mobs of people had chased him through the woods, when he was at his lowest, half mad and starving, unsure who or even what he was anymore, only one person had been at his side. The one glaring at him now. For as much as the old man loved him, although he'd never admit it, he loved Dorina more. Had done, ever since he first set eyes on her. He didn't make a splash of it, but Mircea saw. The extra meat he pulled from his plate to give to the child, who always ate like she was starving. The vociferous haggling he did in the marketplace, shaving a few coins off the price of staples here and there to buy Dorina the sweet she loved. The way he painstakingly taught her to read, determined that the scion of the Bessarabs would be no ignorant street child, no matter how much she seemed to prefer it. The way he was looking at her now, the roomy old eyes shifting from her tortured face to Mircea's and back again, clearly saying, "Fix this." Mircea knelt on the boards and gathered his daughter into his arms. It was easy for him to contain the thrashings that had almost overwhelmed his servant, and to cradle her head without danger, even as she gnashed her teeth and fought him. But while that might keep her from injuring her body, it wouldn't help her mind. Only one thing would do that. The next moment he was sinking inside the tortured brain, into darkness and odd flashes of light, and the vastness of her mental landscape, and almost getting blown away. Because he had broken through into what felt like a hurricane. Exactly like, Mircea thought, as the winds picked him up and flung him what felt like a mile before he hit down, rolling. While overhead a tempest raged, one as strong as the one he'd encountered on the voyage home. No! Mircea thought, shoving the memory away. No! But he wasn't quick enough. She ripped the images from his mind as easily as he could call them up himself. And the next moment, Mircea found himself slammed onto the deck of a ship lost in mountain-sized waves. They loomed on all sides, massive things that dwarfed the vessel that had once seemed so large and now looked like a child's toy. One about to sink. A wave slammed into him from over the side of the ship, washing him into the mainmast and threatening to crack his skull. He hung on nonetheless, trying to think, to concentrate, with waves lashing and winds tearing at him, trying to pull him away from his only support, and almost succeeding, but not because of the environment. But because Horatu had been right. Mircea was afraid. Not for himself. He could leave whenever he chose. But for his daughter, who couldn't. She was trapped here in this hellish place until the fit passed, assuming that it did this time. But what if it didn't? The fits were coming closer together now and were lasting longer. Yet 6 months after they'd first started, he still didn't know what they were or why they were happening or how to stop them. Other than the obvious, of course. Mircea slid down the mast while the winds howled and the storm clouds flashed, unleashing lightning bolts that illuminated the rain-washed boards beneath his hands. The storm was worse now, like it knew what he was going to do, and maybe it did, because the storm was her, the other part of her, who didn't like being caged in this little body, the one who wanted out. But out of where?
It's your body, he wanted to yell, to scream at the skies. There is nothing to escape from. What are you trying to do?
He'd never received an answer. He wasn't sure that she had one, this other side of his daughter, the one he barely knew. She raged like a trapped god, like a force of nature entombed in flesh, who wanted nothing more than to rip her prison to shreds and break free. He was terribly afraid that one day she would manage it. But not this day. Mirta gripped the boards, hard enough to feel splinters biting into his hands. He ignored them. They weren't real, any more than the wind or the waves or the salt that burned his eyes was real. Just manifestations of her power. Power that was overflowing her human body, but had nowhere else to go. Until he gave it one. The boards under his touch began to glow, first a faint luminescence barely limning his fingers in light, and then spreading outward, brighter and farther, lighting up the bones in his hands and the frayed edges of his sleeves while he fought to stay in place. Because, yes, she knew what he was doing, but she couldn't stop him. Not yet. They had a connection, the two of them, because of his mental gifts, or because he was both father and sire in one, or for some other reason he didn't know because he didn't know anything. No one did, not about Domfears. He'd learned that the hard way these last months. The same way he'd learned everything, he thought, as the ship suddenly turned almost perpendicular. It threw him against the side, where the sea tried its best to drown him and debris to impale him, and a lightning burst almost succeeded in incinerating him, but hit a flying barrel instead. Shards of burning wood fell all around him as the ship slammed back down and rocked to the other side, and half the items on deck went airborne. But not Mircha, because he had wrapped his leg in a rope and braced, one arm on a railing and one on the deck. And once more the light under his hand began to spread. He watched it creep outward, illuminating the stains and nails in the boards and the banding on casks and barrels, while the winds shrieked and the waves pounded the little craft as if in anger. But the light flickered on, across the deck and up webs of rigging above tightly furled sails, turning them white-hot and gleaming, until the vessel was covered in light, until it looked like he was kneeling on a ghost ship. And the farther the light reached, the more the waves lessened, the quieter the winds blew, and the more Mircha's hand felt like it was about to combust. And then he did so along with the rest of his body when a lightning strike took him, the bolt coming out of nowhere and landing with a ferocity that tore him off the boards and sent him hurtling backward over the side, screaming, and hitting something with his whole body, hard enough to bruise. It took him a moment to realize that the hard object was his own front door, and that the soggy boards he'd landed on were his floor, where the wet had blown in. And that Dorina was quiet, lying exhausted in his arms as he fought for breath he didn't need, and stared at Horatu, still standing nearby, who looked back at him with pride in the old eyes.
It worked. This time, Mircha rasped,
the power he'd drawn off his daughter thickening his voice and spilling through his skin, lighting the dim room as if someone had decided to burn 100 candles. She was getting stronger. But he was not, at least not fast enough. There was going to come a time when he couldn't drain her sufficiently, and he was desperately afraid that that day would be soon. He had to have help. And there was only one way to get it. Chapter 8 I awoke for the second time with shards of memory poking the soft tissue of my brain. For a moment, weird images overwrote my sunny bedroom. Rain laced with wind, huge waves, an old man with blood on his face.
Shit!
I grabbed my head as a spike of agony lanced through it, courtesy of Dorina's latest blast from the past. Or maybe my headache was food-related because I was also absolutely ravenous. I just lay there, fairly stunned, as the pains in my head and gut fought it out for dominance. Then I shoved them both aside with a snarl, threw back the covers, and headed out the door in search of breakfast. And only succeeded in scandalizing Eamsy, who was sitting in the hall just outside my room. The blonde head with the incongruously baby-fine hair brushed the ceiling, and the massive hands were busy with something I couldn't see over the broad expanse of back. Not even when he turned to glance at me over his shoulder and let out a bleat of alarm. I looked down and sighed, because, of course, Louis César liked to dress me in frilly nightwear, but only when he was going to have the pleasure of removing it again. But since that hadn't been likely this time, he'd left me as I was, buck naked. Not that it should have mattered, I thought, heading back inside. The Fae didn't care much about bodily modesty. They felt that clothes were more for showing off than for covering up, and were therefore optional around the house. At least, that had been the attitude of the troll twins, who had been yelled at repeatedly by Claire when they arrived for letting it all hang out, when the all in question was eye-poppingly huge and hard to miss. In desperation, she'd bought out a fabric store of sturdy canvas cloth and sewn them cargo shorts, and they'd apparently decided that wearing them was better than dealing with my red-headed roommate's famous temper. Although, it was still a good idea to yell out a warning before entering their private sanctum in the basement, and the butt crack of doom was often to be seen looming o'er the yard when Eamsy was in the garden, kneeling over a tiny plant that he was encouraging to grow. However, the same laissez-faire attitude did not apply to me. Not for Eamsy. Not since he'd poked his head in my bathroom one day when I was bathing, and I'd been a little stern with him. I'd apologized later, but it hadn't helped. Once trolls get an idea in their heads, you may as well stop talking. The result was a massive, lumbering teen with the scruples of a Victorian auntie, who I could hear making weird crunching noises outside the door while I struggled to find a tea that didn't make my eyes water. Damn, I needed to do laundry, I thought, crawling out from under the bed, only to see a basket of clean, perfectly folded clothes sitting in front of my closet door. Uh-oh. I sat there for a moment, biting my lip and wondering what Louis César had said to Claire. I shouldn't have left the two of them alone together. I knew I shouldn't. But I had been exhausted and freaked out, and I'd assumed he was just going to decline the soup since I wasn't awake to eat it. But the question was, how had he declined it? Because Claire had afterward felt the need to do my laundry, and that was never a good sign. Claire had a problem with vampires, a relic of a time when she was the unwilling guest of my mad, bad, and very dangerous-to-know late Uncle Vlad. Which wasn't surprising. Most mages felt the same, even if it wasn't PC to say so, and with far less reason than Claire had. But it was a bitch when you happened to be dating one of the aforementioned bloodsuckers who wasn't anything like Vlad. Seriously, we're talking practically a different species here. But try telling Claire that. I knew because I had, which had prompted a begrudging invitation so that two of the most important people in my life could get to know each other. Only that hadn't gone so well. Guess who's coming to dinner had nothing on her and Louis César, politely savaging each other over homemade pot pie. Pie. My stomach grumbled angrily as I remembered flaky crust and Guinness-marinated beefy filling and tender carrots and plump potatoes swimming in the gravy of the gods, studded with onions and little green peas. I quickly pulled on a freshly washed tee and jeans and headed out. Of course, that required edging around Eamsy, who was still blocking the door, and didn't seem to understand that I wanted him to move. And the serious shoving I was doing probably felt like the wafting of a feather to someone with hide like a stegosaurus. A heavy stegosaurus, I added mentally, grunting and groaning and finally managing to push my way past. And then stopped and stared, but not at Eamsy, at the hall beyond him, which was different. "Did somebody die?" I asked, but only got those weird crunching noises back. I stared some more, my eyes trying to figure out what exactly they were seeing. At first, it just looked like every flower in the garden had been squashed into my hall for some reason. Which wasn't that odd, since trolls have a sincere appreciation for beauty and a love of growing things. Sven, the strawberry blonde twin, was currently consumed by the warrior arts, practicing regularly with the light fae contingent in the backyard, who Claire's relatives had sent to guard her. But Eamsy didn't seem interested in learning how to kill things. He had all but taken over Claire's already sizable garden, adding a whole section just for flowers. He often brought me the fruit of his labors stuffed into mason jars or old coffee tins to brighten up my bedside table. But that's not what he had done here. Or, no, I thought, my concern level ramping up a few dozen notches. Not him. Because Eamsy might be talented, but he hadn't managed this.
"Pretty,"
Eamsy said, stealing a glance at me. I nodded. That was one word for it. Of course, I could think of a few others. Because these flowers weren't in jars or vases or cans. They weren't even piled in heaps on the floor. They were growing out of the floor, and the walls, and the ceiling. Especially the ceiling, I thought, staring upward, where great swags of cherry blossoms festooned the old hardwood planks, dipping low enough to brush my head. Some were on new-growth branches that crisscrossed over the plaster. Some came straight out of the old, dusty, been-dead-for-a-century-or-so-now boards. And they were thick, like spring on the National Mall, all squeezed into the area by the stairs, just garlands of them, massing overhead and drooping down the walls, where they could find room. Because the walls were already laden with some kind of growth of their own. And what the hell was that? I looked closer because it looked like someone had installed moving wallpaper. Bright green moving wallpaper, which was busy thrusting out little pods that burst open to spew something at us every few... Oh, I figured it out when I noticed what Eamsy was up to, because he had a basket in his lap and some papery brown things cracking in his fist and was busily doing what trolls did best. Only this time, the fat green clusters of pecan pods were raining down nutty goodness faster than he could eat it, which was pretty damned fast. Although in fairness to Eamsy, he was also being besieged by other crops growing up from the floor. The parquet floor, I realized, blinking. Because the ceiling was century-old cherry wood, the house having been built back before such things were scarce, and the walls were, of course, pecan. But the floor was a scuffed old parquet that I'd never paid much attention to, like to wonder what woods exactly had made it up. Magnolia, oak, and apple, I thought, taking in the huge, white, waxy blooms, the tiny brown acorns, and the rampant pink blossoms that made it look like the floor near the stairs was growing a crazy carpet. One that still followed the zigzag pattern faithfully. Well, except for where Eamsy had harvested parts of it, with a half of his basket that wasn't stuffed with pecans overflowing with the apples that kept bubbling up from the chaos, because the whole growth thing appeared to be set on fast forward. "Well, shit," I said. Eamsy gave me a commiserating look and proffered an apple. "Thanks." I took a bite. It was good. Of course it was. I started wondering if I could fit through the tiny round window at the end of the hall when Eamsy thwarted my escape plans by picking me up and depositing me in front of the stairs, where a cascade of apples he couldn't reach had overflowed the floor design and were bump, bump, bumping down the steps alongside my feet, and where the pecan pods hung from actual branches, brushing my head as their produce erupted at me like brown rain and then rolled everywhere. I somehow got downstairs without breaking my neck and peered inside the kitchen door. Yep, That's what I'd thought.
Dory, you're up!
I was also halfway turned around and headed for the front door, but the desperation in Claire's voice stopped me. Because her housekeeping frenzy wasn't, as I'd supposed, due to irritation at Louis César, but to something else entirely. Something worse. Something sitting at the kitchen table, perched on a stool with a cutting board in front of him, holding out a finger.
Dorina.
The lilting voice made my name sound like a cascade of bells.
Come and see. I am wounded.
It was said with all the panache of a dying hero announcing a mortal blow. I sighed and turned back around.
Hello, Cademan.
Come, he demanded. Kiss it better.
He waggled the supposedly injured digit at me. I sighed again and walked into the kitchen. Most women would have been happy to kiss it, or anything else Cademan chose to name. He was Claire's soon-to-be father-in-law, but he didn't look it. I don't know how to adequately describe how he did look, because there's simply no practical equivalent. We're talking 7 feet of finely muscled leanness, hair like actual sunlight, as if it glowed from within, eyes like genuine emeralds, deep green and glinting with an odd mix of wit and wisdom, and a face that would have been literally stunning if it wasn't currently pouting like a child. Or maybe not a child, I thought, as one side of those sculpted lips edged upward, barely a fraction of an inch, and yet miraculously changed the expression from sass to seduction. He waggled the finger at me again. Healing's not really my specialty, I told him, leaning against the table. I'd only hurt it more. The knot smile edged up another tenth of an inch.
How much more?
He sounded intrigued. Let me see your knife.
Dory!
Claire sounded a little shrill, like she was afraid we were going to duel it out right there in her kitchen. Which wasn't likely, even if I'd been in any shape to take on a king of the light fae. Because where was the room? The kitchen wasn't as bad as my hallway, but there had been some additions. Cademan was king of what was known on Earth as the Blarestri, one of the three great houses of the light fae. It wasn't their real name, of course, which we mere mortals weren't good enough to have, just a placeholder meaning the Blue Fae. But it was descriptive of their realm, high in the mountain fastnesses of Faerie, with blue skies all around and lush greenery everywhere. Because nature loved Cademan. Literally, I thought, as a little vine tried to twine itself in his long, flowing hair.
There, there.
He said absently and pulled it out, to wind it around the back of a chair instead. It had a lot of company. Claire's window box garden, where she grew the herbs she used for cooking, had exploded, for lack of a better term. It was now a window jungle, one leaning not outward toward what looked like late afternoon sun, but inward, scrawling across sink and countertops and floor like a toddler's drawing, and then climbing here, there, and everywhere, just to get a little closer to the glowing fae sitting at the table. It wasn't the only one. The bedraggled pot of begonias that Claire had brought inside and placed on top of the fridge had draped the appliance in dark green leaves. They were huge and healthy now, and framing clusters of crimson flowers that brushed the floor on either side. They made the old, dented fridge look like it was wearing a long red wig, one more luxurious than Claire's currently frazzled locks.
"Stop it,"
she muttered, as another mass suddenly plopped over the fridge front, like bangs, making the resemblance that much more startling. "What's for dinner?" I asked. Because priorities are priorities. And if I had to deal with Cademan, I was going to need energy.
Soup,
she said curtly, and then jumped when a spider plant, including pot, suddenly slammed in the screen door from the outside, pulling itself along on its weird little hand-like protrusions, earthworming toward its god.
Oh, for... Dory!
Got it, I told her, scooping the crazed thing up, and presenting it to Cademan, who sighed as it wound its creepy little vine hands about him in a fervent embrace.
At least something loves me, he said soulfully.
What are you doing here? I asked, taking the thankfully glass cutting board and wailing on some carrots before they sprouted, because he was clearly too injured with his paper-cut-like wound to manage it himself, and I wanted to eat already.
Helping with dinner.
Claire, looking tired and sweaty, shot him a glance over her shoulder. He failed to notice, being too busy petting his new admirer.
I always like to be a thoughtful guest.
Uh-huh. And why are you guesting, exactly? The beautiful green eyes widened.
Why, to see my grandson.
And?
Oh, how remiss of me.
Cademan took my hand and kissed it playfully.
And your lovely self, of course.
I sighed and looked skyward, and got clobbered by a bushel of apples, because a tree branch had inched its way in from the hall, pushing aside the old boards of the ceiling until it found a more formidable foe in the brass ship's lantern in the center, and then dropping half a bushel of fruit during the epic battle between them. Onto my head.
Cademan!
Claire whirled on him, hearing my surprised yelp, and then hurried over, wiping her hands on her apron and reaching for me because her old profession, before she traded it in for Fae Princess, was nurse. I'm okay, I told her. I'd managed to dodge most of them.
By luck? She's supposed to be recuperating, she told Cademan furiously.
Really?
He looked me over.
Ill?
Injured.
Ah, I can relate.
You are not injured,
Claire snapped, grabbing a box of band-aids from a cabinet and slamming them down in front of his paper cut. Cademan looked at them sadly. They were SpongeBob, which I suppose he felt was lèse majesté. He opened the box anyway.
And can you please stop this?
She gestured around at the leafy carnage.
It will stop on its own in a bit,
he assured her.
I'd prefer it to stop now, she said, as several apples plopped into the soup.
Claire went to scoop them out while I watched a little tendril on Cademan's shoulder wind around the point of his ear.
Why can't you stop it now? I asked.
The same reason I don't simply heal my wound. Too much power buzzing about.
What?
He grinned and flexed SpongeBob at me.
I might grow an extra finger.
I decided to quit while I was ahead, but Claire was braver than me.
And why do you have so much power buzzing about?
The perfect lips made a slight moo.
There was a bit of a dust-up getting through the portal. Oh, nothing serious, he assured us. Although it's sweet of you to be concerned for me.
Claire didn't look concerned. She looked pissed. And sounded it, too.
Dust up? I thought you said everything was fine at home, and that's why you could afford to leave.
Well, yes, it is, he agreed. At home. But we weren't at home.
We?
Hadar and I.
And now Claire did look concerned, and with reason. Hadar, her fiancé, and Cademan's son had recently gone on a scouting trip into territory controlled by another great fey house, and not one of the nice ones. The Svarestri, a.k.a. the Black Fey, due to the color of their armor, were heavily involved with the group currently trying to go Chuck Norris on our asses.
You were with Hadar?
Claire said sharply.
Yes.
Where is he? Is he all right? You said there was an attack.
It was nothing, Cademan said soothingly. I sent him through one portal and took another myself,
although it was a bit of a ride to get there.
Why did you take another?
Cademan looked like he was debating something, possibly lying.
Cademan?
The first disappeared, somewhat abruptly. The Sfarestri caused a landslide.
Landslide?
Claire suddenly sat down. Hadar made it through well before, Cademan assured her. I sent him back to one of our staging areas and fought my way clear.
And came here, and not to see Aiden, as you said,
Claire accused, talking about her and Hadar's child and Cademan's current heir. I do want to see him, Cademan protested.
That would be a first.
Cademan looked put upon. A little cactus in the middle of the table bristled, as if about to come to his defense. Claire threw a dish rag over it. You know we've been through this, Cademan said. Our women raise the male children until they are old enough to handle a sword, after which the men in the family take over. To do otherwise would break tradition, and also make him appear.
Cademan!
Claire's complexion was getting dangerously close to her hair color.
Why are you here?
He sighed prettily. Oh, very well. And while I was visiting my charming grandson, I was wondering if I might borrow a little something.
Borrow?
Claire looked confused, probably wondering what we had that would interest a Fey king.
Borrow what?
Nothing much. Just, ah, there he is.
Cademan smiled and held out his arms.
My boy.
I looked up to see a tow-headed Aiden, still in his jammies, because when you're a year old, any time is jammy time. He was looking angelic, all big blue eyes and blonde hair like his daddy, and standing in the kitchen doorway next to my own little bundle of terror, who was Porky Pigging it in a ratty T-shirt and dragging a battered pink bear, which had already lost most of an ear. I sighed.
Grandpa!
Aiden raced across the kitchen floor, which had mercifully not yet sprouted anything, and jumped, and was plucked up and spun around by an obviously delighted Fey King, who, okay, maybe had wanted to see his grandson a little bit, because he was grinning hugely.
How you've grown, he told Aiden,
lifting him overhead, where the apples politely drew back out of the way.
Such a fine, handsome boy.
I picked up Stinky, who was not a fine, handsome boy, but deserved some love, too.
Do you like your bear?
I asked him, which had traces of soot on it in addition to the badly mangled left ear, but was otherwise holding up pretty well. He nodded, but I clearly didn't have his full attention. The wizened, fuzzy face, which sort of looked like a monkey, a muppet, and a snaggle-toothed cat had met up in a blender, was focused on the sword at Cademan's side instead. It was a beautiful thing I hadn't noticed because he'd been sitting down, and because I'd never seen him feel the need to go about armed while inside before.
Not yet, dear boy,
he told Stinky, smiling down at the face of his grandson's staunch friend.
That day will come soon enough. Enjoy the time you have now.
Cademan!
Claire was nothing if not persistent.
Borrow what?
He looked back at her, blinking, while holding Aiden up again so that he could pick a fruit.
Oh, nothing much, my dear. Just a few dozen dragons.
Chapter 9. I was saved by the bell, the one on the front door, to be exact, which took that moment to start clamoring for attention. I gladly gave it some because the decibel level in the kitchen was mounting, and because I was hoping it was the Girl Scouts, since it didn't look like I was going to be getting dinner any time soon. It wasn't the Girl Scouts. It took me a second, because it looked like I had a bunch of clean-cut Mormons on the stoop who'd decided that they needed extra support for the crazy house, so had brought the whole congregation, But then I noticed that the smiling faces were a little too fixed, the eyes were a little too blank, and the air above their heads was shimmering a little too much. And, suddenly, it was like those dot painting